In the book of Titus, we look at a relatively new church and a church struggling with some issues that need to be put in order. And so we're going to look at the issue of the elders in some detail, and actually I have split the messages up with the first message consisting of what the elders should not be, and then the second consisting of what they should be. And so I'm going to read this again. Titus 1, verses 5 through 7. And I also have a little different, what you would call a rough Greek translation, which is more word for word, and I'm going to read as well. For this reason, I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains, and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. Namely, if any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion, for the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain. And the slightly different translation, for this cause I left you behind in Crete that you might further put in order the things which are lacking and might establish in each city elders as I directed you. If anyone is unaccused, for it is necessary for the overseer to be unaccused as God's steward, husband of one wife, having believing children, not involved in accusation of dissoluteness or uncontrolled, not self-pleasing, not soon angry, not beside wine, not a striker, not shamefully greedy of gain, but hospitable, a lover of goodness, sound-minded, righteous, holy, self-controlled, holding firm to the faithful word in accordance with the doctrine, in order that he may be able to both exhort in the teaching what is healthful and refute those contradicting. So we have no record in the book of Acts of Paul preaching on Crete, but churches had evidently been started on Crete, whether Paul personally visited them or not. He was certainly well informed of what was going on and the issues. Titus was on Crete to continue the ministry. Now, the phrase that Paul left Titus on Crete leads me to believe that he had been there, but those who know more than I do about translation say the Greek term could also mean dispatch or assign. So the word put in order has a prefix which means in addition. So there's a couple of things he's to do. He's to appoint elders, and he's to put things in order in the churches. And then Paul is going to give instruction about the selection and the issues that need to be put in order. In the selection of elders, you can see parallel commands in the instructions to Timothy. The elders will lead the churches and assure that the doctrine is sound. So elders or presbyteros are to be appointed. And the term is interchanged with overseers, although in longer established churches, an overseer could be chosen from a number of elders. The list of qualifications in Timothy is a little more distinct, starting with overseer and then going to deacon, and there's qualifications for both. In the passage of 1 Timothy 3:5 goes from household management for the overseer to church management, with an explanation tucked in the middle saying that a man who cannot manage his own household cannot then be given the household of the church to manage. In these new churches, there could have been few or even only one elder in each church, and so elder and overseer could be one of the same. And I know some of the churches that are struggling, some of the churches, because our brother Kyle Franklin is going to speak tonight, that got dwindling small and then are being brought back, might not have many elders, or maybe not any, or deacons, if you prefer that term. Paul reminds Titus he previously directed this should be done, and Titus probably had a pretty good idea of the qualifications which are written in the letters. Elders are to be unaccused, are not called into question. And like the instructions, the parallel ones in 1 Timothy, this would mean both inside and outside the church. So a man with a shady reputation outside the church is not a good candidate for elder. Him having an office inside the church could damage the testimony or reputation of the church. So a translation of blameless or above reproach would convey that concept. And Paul explains that such a man is a steward of God. And steward had a lot of meaning in those times. Not so much now. If you're going to get a steward now, you would get somebody that was bonded. Okay? And that means there's a bond company that's willing to stake their money on the fact that this person will not do anything wrong. So a steward had to have the ability to manage. There had to be ability there. But above and beyond the ability, it was most vital he be faithful. That was the most important, because a steward was understood in those days to be entrusted with some things of value that belonged to somebody else. And he's supposed to take watchful care of those things. I have heard it expressed that someone in a position should take care of the master's things or the boss's things as though they were his own. But that's not really correct. A steward has to be more careful of the things that belong to the master than of his own. If it's his own, he's free to spend it or give it away or throw it away or even waste his own things. But if he's foolish or wasteful with the things of the master, he's liable to be called to account. And so an overseer is a steward of the things of God. And these things have great value. And so he's supposed to take care of these precious things of which he's been entrusted. And we have parables in the gospel about stewards, and they praise faithful stewards and give them more responsibility, and they show punishment for wasteful stewards and slothful stewards. Because we remember the story of the steward that buried his money in the ground and he gave it back and he said, see, it's all here. And he was called wicked and slothful because he didn't do anything with it. And so the idea here is that the gospel, okay, the testimony of Jesus Christ, the salvation that came at the cross, is a very precious commodity of which the overseer is steward. He doesn't own it, okay? No preacher, no church owns salvation and can say, yes, you're going to get in, or no, you're not going to get in. He's the steward of it. He presents it. In the domestic sphere, he used to have a certain relationship with wife and children. He used to be the husband of one wife, and the sense here is being faithful. Monogamy was pretty standard at the time in the Roman Empire, so men did not necessarily have multiple wives, but many men had mistresses, and wealthy men had female slaves. So even if a man only had one wife, an arrangement like that would disqualify them from being an elder. Even though some of these relationships were common in the culture of the times, Paul is saying, no, That's not coming into the leadership of the church. His children were to be believers. Pagan children would cause division in the household. And there's a sense here that the man and the household are to offer a testimony of salvation to the community at large and also to the church. And the children were not to be unruly. The word dissolute is pretty broad, and it can speak to many things: improper use of money or gluttony, drunkenness, wasteful or wild excess. Uncontrolled, it shows a sense of rebellion or not heeding instruction. So we see here the testimony of the children as their lives would make an impact on our potential elder. Back years ago, I remember a man who was nominated to be a deacon, and a group of us all sat down with the pastor to go over these various things in Timothy and Titus. And so when it came his turn, the man said very frankly that his family was not under control, and he wasn't able to bring it under control. And so he would politely decline the nomination to deacon. I respected that man. He spoke up, he laid out the facts, and explained what it was and what he could and couldn't do. Now, from the domestic household, the household he's managing, and Paul turns to general characteristics. And it says, not self-willed in the one I have, and not self-pleasing in the other translation I'm studying from. And self-pleasing is a very interesting description, and we need to think about it a little bit. What does it mean? The self-pleasing man looks to himself first. You could say that he's selfish, but it's really more than that. Because the self-pleasing man in a leadership role is going to work hard to shape the ministry to his wishes. Okay, this is what I want. This is where it's going to go. And he's using the leadership in ways that make him happy. So as he bends the ministry to his desires, like you bend a piece of wood if you're making something, stresses and strains are going to appear. It's inevitable. And that could become a self-defeating cycle, because as he tries harder and harder to use his own self-pleasing methods to minister rather than trying to repent or humble himself in the role of servant, more and more stresses and strains appear. More difficulties arise. Now, we know that the word for deacon comes from the word for servant. There's a reason for that. You remember what Jesus said? You know that the Gentiles lord it over their servants, and the leaders use great authority. It's not supposed to be like that with you. But whoever wants to be great is going to have to be servant of all. If you are serving, it's nearly impossible to be self-pleasing at the same time. What did they say about Jesus? A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So the heart of the servant is not self-pleasing. Think about Paul. He said he tried to be all things to all men so that by all means he could at least save some. Now, There are many ways to lead, multiple ways. And it's quite possible to take a position and be correct, but not be pleasant. And it's also possible to select one way out of many to accomplish some goal. But the problem is we tend to presume that the way we select is the only way, or the only correct way. You know, there's the right way, the wrong way, then there's my way. Should you do that, it becomes much less likely that you're going to successfully persuade somebody to follow or to come in with your argument on your side. So Paul tried to present the gospel in a way that would tend to make his audience receptive. Now, he didn't change the gospel. He didn't water down the gospel. He didn't take parts out or he didn't add parts in. But he presented it in a way to make his audience perceptive and receptive. What am I saying? He studied and understood the Jewish law at the level of expert. He'd studied with Gamaliel. He knew the law. But his personal preferences were set aside in order to serve Christ and present the gospel so that it would be accepted. So to the Jews, he spoke in a certain way with great respect for the law. And the Gentiles, who knew nothing about the law, he did not use the law in his persuasion. Didn't mean anything to them. Paul's aim was to preach the gospel and serve Christ. And he set his own preferences aside in order to reach the goal. So, I mean, this is my goal. This is where I'm going. I want to preach. I want to preach Christ crucified. I want to preach salvation, remission of sins. But the self-pleasing man is selfish in that he's confident that he's always right. I had a little sign one time in my office, and I don't even remember where I got it. But what it said is, those of you who think you know everything are very annoying to those of us who do. Anyway, the self-pleasing man is confident that he's always right. So there's no need to tailor his message to the benefit of the particular audience he wants to reach. There's no need to amend his methods. Now, I've known of cases where a preacher left a church and moved on to a different ministry, and some of his old congregation was traveling, and they stopped in and worshiped in his new church on a given Sunday. And they came back and they said, "He doesn't sound a bit the same. It's quite different. I don't know what's happened to him." Well, I'll tell you what happened to him. He's in a different church, in a different situation, maybe a different culture, different levels of income, different problems, different issues. And he's tailoring the message as he gets to know his flock. He's tailoring his message to his people. He's trying to be all things to all people so that by all means he can save some or edify some, presuming they're already saved. He's not doing it just the same because he's not a self-pleasing man. He's looking to serve. Well, our self-pleasing man is all about the message as he's pleased to give it or some particular method he thinks is good that shouldn't be modified in any way, because why should you change something that's already ideal? So there's no need to listen to or respect the opinions of others. Now, this would also describe the stubborn man that always wants to have his own way. You ever met one of those? Ever been one of those? He can be willful. He can be a micromanager. And the micromanager micromanages because he hates to delegate authority because other people just can't do it right. But in the church, we need to put the interests of the church first. And so we can't necessarily work the way we wish. There's considerations to be made. There's people to be shepherded. There's people to be edified. There's people to be helped. Well, the overseer that wants to do things his way has the unflagging belief that his way is the right way. And it could be right. It could be right. But you also need to listen and not be selfish and proud, because it's damaging to the ministry. Now, if there's resistance or pushback to some method or some ministry, what are you going to do? Okay. Are you going to say, well, I can't be wrong, so it must be lack of spiritual discernment on the part of the congregation? I can't possibly be wrong. Or do you say, well, I better sit down and think about some things. I better talk to some people. Maybe I need to mend some fences. I need to see why there's an issue. One of the hardest things to look at when there's an issue or a problem is the fact that there could be a problem with me. However, the man who is not self-pleasing is willing to look at that possibility. Could there be a problem with me? Guess what? There could. And the opposite of that is the unfailing belief, and they just do everything my way, God would certainly bless the ministry. Self-pleasing. If you set out to please yourself, chances are good you will at first, but the thing could get unpleasant at the end. Not soon angry. That would mean, in this context, prone to anger. The opposite of that, of course, is patience. Long-suffering. Everybody gets angry sometimes. Some more than others. But not everybody is prone to anger or quick to get angry. If you're dealing with people, and the gospel, the church, the ministry, it's people business. It's all about people. And when you're dealing with all these things, anger is never helpful. So when you're dealing with people, you need to kind of keep your emotions in check. You can't be screaming at people. You can't be flying off the handle. The angry person is not logical. The angry person is not loving. So in the midst of anger, logic just flies out the window. You know, that's when words get spoken that should have better been not spoken. So when trying to solve a problem, the most likely aspect of the angry person is they've lost control of the situation. They're no longer setting the agenda. They're no longer trying to go from step A to step B. Now, dealing with people in a church, you got everyone from new converts to people who privately think they know more than you do. It can be a trial of patience. Long-suffering, you might say. But anger is never a good way to put their feet on the right path. So if you got a hair-trigger temper and you can go off at a moment's notice, Paul is saying, well, you're not really elder material. Not beside wine is a literal translation. I found it interesting. Most of the translations say something like not addicted to wine. It's a picture here. It's the same translation, 1 Timothy 3:3. So in the first century, wine was the common drink. And the perils of drunkenness were well known. There's admonitions about drunkenness. The wine, which was cheap enough for the common people, was pretty well watered down, not so potent as the drinks that are served to this day. And of course, churches do differ on the subject. This church is a temperance church, and so they do not permit the use of alcohol as a beverage. I know some churches do other things, but we can't talk about that today. But to return to the phrase, not beside wine, it's a picture of the person who sits by the wine supply or the wine keg. He's by it so he can get all he wants. And of course, this is another terminology for someone addicted to it. And it's funny, when I read that explanation in the commentary, all of a sudden, the light bulb went off in my feeble brain, because I've seen that person. I've seen that person. As I worked in government service, it was obligatory to go to a number of social events. And in the course of those social events, there was quite often alcohol involved. And you would see a core of people who were beside the alcohol. They were there. They were close by. And they wanted to get all they could manage while the event was underway. Even more so when someone else was paying for and furnishing the alcohol. So, from that culture to this, there's still that individual. And the description right afterwards says, not a striker. So I think that the juxtaposition of those two is not accidental. The person who is very anxious to get all the drinks they can hold is quite apt also to be quarrelsome. Today we'd call them the mean drunk. You can find them in any watering hole on a Friday or Saturday night, even to this day, although they're best avoided, and they often are. In 1 Timothy, there's an admonition after the command not to be beside wine concerning being quarrelsome. So those two are right next to each other in both. The quarrelsome person is like the person soon angry. They're going to have difficulty dealing with people. They're going to have a shaky testimony. Next we see not shamefully greedy of gain. Boy, that covers a lot of ground. Now, the Cretan culture of the time, historians regarded them as being very avaricious, accused of harboring pirates, accused of harboring robbers, illicit gain. And so Paul is looking at this culture. He does not want it to come into the church. The American culture today is a very consumer-driven culture. And we're very interested in stuff. Clothing, houses, cars, hobbies, you name it. Electronics, cell phones, smartphones, Android phones, phones I don't even know about yet. They're all out there. And so, you know, who has the latest, who knows what? But in order to enjoy this consumer culture, you need the requisite finances to indulge yourself. So, Paul is looking at the local culture in Crete, and he doesn't want that to come into the church. 1 Timothy, it says that the overseer should be free from the love of money, and deacons are not to be fond of sordid gain. Now, to be greedy is something of a mindset. And it's really in opposition to the ministry of the church. Why do I say that? The greedy mindset is about getting and keeping. Paul says they should be holding tight to the gospel, like you're holding the hand of a child on the street. But the greedy lifestyle is about getting stuff or getting money, getting some kind of material possession, and keeping it or increasing it. So being greedy will cause you to hang on tight to all that you have while you're in the process of trying to get more. I was in a house one time when I was inspecting houses, and that house was full of stuff from the floor to the ceiling. I mean, full. There's just a little path to get through. And the old lady that lived there just couldn't bring herself to throw anything out. You know? Junk mail from 10 years ago. I'm going to read that and do something with it sometime. Newspapers. I'm going to cut out some pictures and put them in an album. I mean, she couldn't live properly because of the stuff. I told her, if you get a spark in here with all this paper, you're going to burn up like a hamburger. You got to thin this place out a little bit. You can't, it's not safe to live like this. Well, everything had a use. Everything had a value. She didn't want to part with anything. Ministry is a process of giving. We give out the gospel. Paul said, I'm happy to spend and be spent for your benefit. Your pastor would tell you the same thing. He's pleased to do it. He's happy to do it. He enjoys doing it. So people in ministry have a desire to give. They want to give of their time. They want to give of their talent. They want to give out the gospel. And in order to give out the gospel, it's necessary to give out some other things as well. Time, talent, money. In the process of giving, there will be many facets of giving. So Christians should be marked by a desire to give. Everybody has a different gift. Everybody has a different talent. You know, look at the service today. We had ladies who came up here and sang. They had a desire to give of their talent. If you want to know about my singing, I might turn to the person in back of me and say, sing louder. I can still hear myself. But some people have a talent in that area, and so they have a desire to give. And the desire to give is not common due to human nature. Human nature is all about us. What can we get? And so when you see somebody that's acting contrary to basic human nature, it leads you to ask yourself, why is this person this way? And perhaps you'll ask them. And perhaps then they will tell you that I am a Christian. I have a desire to give. I have a desire to do good to all men, starting with the household of faith. The Christian is zealous for good works, a peculiar people zealous for good works. And virtually any good work involves giving something. But the greedy man has a hard time escaping the desire to get something. We have a lot of people like that in our world today. We deal with them. We deal with them on a daily basis. But Paul is saying they can't come into the leadership of the church. Can they come in a congregation? Can they listen to the message? Can they be edified? Yes. Now, those in oversight positions also have access to money. Might be for the relief of the poor. Once in a blue moon, you see church funds being embezzled. It's rare. And when it happens, there's always a great amount of shock. Here in this church, we got old-timers like Al Halliday, Steve Andrianoff, and when the money from the collection is counted, they always make sure there's at least two or maybe three people there. Why? It's a good practice. It's a good, especially when dealing with cash money. Do we not trust people? No, we certainly trust them. But good above board practices are a good idea. So they are to be blameless or unaccused. And because they have to be unaccused, the greedy person is going to be known for that particular vice in the community. And once again, having such a person as an overseer is damaging to the reputation of the church. So we're looking for the willingness to help and the willingness to share. The willingness to give of whatever it is you happen to have. That's a basic part of the Christian ethic, and the greedy man might begrudge that necessary activity. We're in the giving business. That's what we do. Well, these are the negative issues. These are the things that Paul is saying the overseer should not be. And as I said before, much of that is a question of the local culture, which has got to stay outside the church. It can't come in. We have a whole different local culture in America today. But the issue has not changed a bit from the time of Paul. There has to be a certain amount of care that the common culture and the mores and the standards of the common culture don't come into the church. because the commands for the church are laid out in the scripture, and that is what we are to follow. Now, customs change, different ideas change, many things change. And we have to be careful, too, that we can't let our preferences of what we're used to be confused with doctrine, which is not allowed to be changed. Okay, so if I was in some different countries, I would be up here with an ornate shirt that was quite long and a pair of pants, and I'd be dressed up very well. In other countries, I might be in a robe. Okay, in other countries, something quite different. Does that matter? No, it doesn't matter. We try to put forward our best when we come to church on Sunday, but the best is different in different places. That's an example of a preference. Salvation by grace through faith in Christ is not a preference. That's the heart of the gospel. That's what we're all about. That can't change. We won't change it. But there's many other things that are. So anyway, these are some of the negative issues, what Paul said. I don't want that coming into the church. We know it's out there. We can't help the fact that it's out there. Okay? The church is light shining in a dark place. Therefore, we don't want the darkness coming in. Next time, we'll speak about the positive attributes, the things that the elder is supposed to have, which is also extraordinarily interesting, and I think very timely even now. So we'll have Steve come up and have our closing hymn now.